You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 33 of the Prehistories Podcast. This is the third installment of our folk horror special, and I am left quite disturbed by the discussions today, especially of the recent film Midsommar. I take it that if you're listening, you're a fan of horror and you can cope with discussions of violence and death. I'm a wimp, so I found it quite hard. I'm sure you'll enjoy it, but don't say you weren't warned. So, we had quite a lot of trouble recording Lauren's audio, but due to, you know, Wi-Fi problems and things like that. But we're back with Dr. Lauren McIntyre. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great, and I can hear you.
Hooray!
And
it's fantastic.
Yay! So happy to get you on the podcast, because this was basically all your idea.
Yeah, it was. I was really good when we had all the tech issues last time, but I'm here now. I'm in now.
You are. And we can hear you loud and clear, and it's beautiful.
Good stuff.
So, yeah. So I'm going to introduce you again just in case the audio didn't work in the last one. So Lauren is a senior osteoarchaeologist with the company Oxford Archaeology, and you're working on you work with skeletal material, human skeletal material, mm-hmm. most of the time, don't you?
Yes.
And are you working on projects at the moment?
I am. I'm a lead osteologist of our Trinity Burial Ground project in Hull. I can't say too much about it because it's in progress, but basically we are working in a post-medieval cemetery that's been cleared out in lieu of a road widening scheme.
Right, yeah. This is the thing, isn't it? I mean, sometimes one of the things that archaeologists get accused of is grave robbing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And the problem is that all of the reasons for why cemeteries are cleared, nothing to do with archaeologists. We're rescuing the people who have been buried in those places when they've been, as you say, cleared out for a road or for a housing or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the way I see it is, I mean, I prefer not to have to move these people, but
yeah,
needs must. And if it wasn't the archaeologists going in there moving these people carefully and with respect and consideration, it'd probably be bulldozers going in and doing it. So I think that we're probably the better option.
Exactly. Yeah. So one of the reasons, because we tried a couple of times, didn't we, to record, and one of the reasons was that you were in Hull.
Yes.
Yeah. One of the reasons we couldn't get good audio is, I'm afraid Hull doesn't, or at least where you were anyway, didn't have very good Wi-Fi.
No, the whole Wi-Fi was terrible.
Poor Hull. Oh dear. But we're both Yorkshire people, are we?
Yes. Yeah, I'm from Sheffield.
Ah, yes. Well, I'm from Leeds, but you can't really tell that much anymore because I came down south, married a southerner, worked at a palace and lost most of my accent.
You'll be getting your Yorkshire passport revoked.
I know. Yeah, totally. It's terrible. But there you go. And then obviously we come down south for all the work. That's the thing, mm-hmm. isn't it? And then get sent back up north to do the digging. But you're also an associate lecturer at Oxford Brookes University, and you teach. Is it osteoarchaeology that you're basically teaching there, or forensic archaeology?
It's osteoarchaeology and paleopathology that I teach at Brookes.
Ah, excellent. So I bet, is it very popular?
It is, yeah. In fact, the last couple of times, obviously I didn't teach last year because all the in-person teaching was cancelled because of COVID, mm-hmm. and you can't really teach osteology online.
Virtually.
Yeah, it's, you really need that sort of tactile, hands-on experience.
Yeah.
But it got to a point where we had so many undergraduates subscribing to the class that we had to split it into two groups because we couldn't actually fit everybody in the laboratory.
Wow, that's great. I mean, it is so fascinating, isn't it? I think there's something really just deep in our psyche about wanting to research other people, past people. But is it based at all on a kind of a macabre interest in dead people and bones, or is it much more of kind of a virtuous urge to study them? What do you think?
I think for a lot of people, there is probably an element of that. There's always like a bit of morbid curiosity. And I think people have kind of got like that innate morbid curiosity about stuff anyway, even if they won't admit it. That's why there's like such an increase in things like death tourism, like in the last few years.
Yeah.
But I think even for any students that have signed up because of that, I think once they get into the class, they do start getting interested in like the science of it and what you can tell and the archaeology. And I mean, I always say to them that there's not really any more direct way of learning about people who lived in the past than actually looking at the people who were there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And especially with all the scientific techniques that can be used now with bones as well, with taking samples and getting, you know, chemical analyses done and things like that is amazing, really. But also just, as you say, the pathology that you find on them as well, mm-hmm. which obviously must be, it's unusual. Well, I was always taught when I was doing a bit of osteology that it was unusual to find pathology on bones. There's not that many causes of death that leave marks on the bones. Is that right? Or do you find quite a lot of pathology?
We do find a lot of pathology. I think the distinction to make is that we don't very often find evidence of cause of death, but we do find a lot of evidence of disease and health status. So right. People will have evidence of activity and infection or disease and trauma and all sorts of things like that without it necessarily having killed them.
Right.
So we may occasionally see somebody who has, say, got perimortem head trauma, and we know that they died because they were hit over the head with something. But for the most part, the types of trauma that we're seeing are from long-standing disease, from even things like arthritis.
Yeah.
That's pathology. And arthritis is not going to kill you. Well, not unless you're really unlucky. But we're seeing a lot of these like long-standing things that where people have had an illness or something that they've had it for such a long time that it has affected their skeleton.
Yeah, I suppose you're right, yeah. And a lot of tooth abscesses and stuff like that, is that the kind of thing you find?
Oh, yeah, lots of stuff like that. Dental pathology is really, really common.
I was so lucky to have, like, toothbrushes and toothpaste and mouthwash. I mean, and dentists that actually know what they're doing.
Oh, we are, yeah, for sure. Dental pathology can be absolutely hideous. I mean, even things like, because people aren't brushing their teeth, like the amount of dental calculus, which is basically mineralized plaque deposits on your teeth. So the furry stuff that you feel on the surface of your teeth when you've drank a can of Coke or eaten something sugary.
Yeah.
Just the amount of that kind of stuff that builds upon people's teeth and then they don't bother to clean it off is just hideous.
Yeah. Oh, it's amazing. I hear that you got a teaching award as well.
Oh, I didn't actually get the teaching award, unfortunately.
Oh, but,
no, my students
but
actually...
You were nominated.
My students nominated me for a teaching award, which is really
lovely.
Oh,
it's just an honour to be nominated, as they say. That is great, though. I mean, that's a real feeling of that you're being valued and appreciated. That's wonderful.
Yeah, the fact that they actually bothered to do it was wonderful.
Yeah, no, because, you know, students, they don't bother to do stuff.
No, they don't. So.
We love you, students. You're great. So that's really cool. Lauren, is your interest, and did you get into doing osteoarchaeology and looking at people's bones because of your interest in horror, or was it the other way around?
I think that these two passions have grown up slightly independently of each other. I always wanted to study archaeology, and then I kind of got into the skeletal side of things a little bit later on. In terms of my consumption of horror, that started at rather an early age with things like watching Halloween with my mum when I was in my early teens and things like that, and it kind of grew from there.
So it didn't scar you then, because that's what scarred me. I went to a birthday party, I think I said this to the other guys, when I was 11, and their mum put on Nightmare on Elm Street, and I just cannot watch any horror after that because it was too young for me. And I was a delicate flower.
I think there's a lot of stuff that I'd seen. And I think actually growing up like in the late 80s and early 90s, I think that a lot of the kids' TV programs had more of a horror element than they do now, especially in the late 80s.
Yes.
Some of the stuff that was on then was like horrifying. Like, and you look at it now and think, Jesus, that was a kids' program.
Yeah.
And so I think that's so true. All that stuff has like seeded this love of horror, and then it's just grown, and probably like in the last 10, 15 years, it's become much more of an obsession.
Well, it's such a big market, isn't it? I think, and there's been some, it's really grown, I think, over the last, as you say, last 10, 20 years, and had just had a lot of money put into it, so that it's all, you know, really quite good, well made, you know, well produced, and cinematography is really part of it. And not that I obviously watch that much, but there's even some that really, what kind of, I really want to watch, but I know that I just wouldn't be able to handle it. I mean, basically the best I can do is to watch something like for instance, you mentioned the film The Ritual, which is set, I think it's in Norway, is it? And it's about trolls and sacrificing people to the trolls. I've seen Troll Hunter, and that's enough for me. Thank you very much. It's a lovely, very funny film with ridiculous trolls in it. And that's about my level.
Which is fine. Like, not everybody's going to like, it's brilliant. I love Troll Hunter.
Yeah. It's my alternative Christmas film.
Oh, really? That's nice. Yeah. Have you seen Rare Exports?
Oh, yeah. I love Rare Exports. Oh, we're going to have to get together to do a Christmas horror episode this Christmas.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, Christmas horror is totally a thing as well.
Yeah, Krampus and stuff like that as well. So, yeah.
Oh, loads of stuff.
Let's revisit this in a few months for Christmas.
Oh, for sure.
Cool. So, and when you talk about your kind of obsession with horror, it's a very creative obsession, because you're involved with quite a few different websites and things, aren't you? And podcasts, in order to be talking about horror and reviewing horror. Like you were a reviewer on the website Horrorcist, and you've been working on socially distanced cinema reviews as well for different kind of online film festivals and stuff. Mm-hmm. And you've got a new podcast coming out as well. Give that a plug.
So myself and Dr. Chloe Duckworth, Archaeoduck, as Archaeoduck, she's also known online, we've been putting together a YouTube series where, as we record this, we're hoping that the first episode is going to be coming out in the next couple of days. So me and Chloe have been looking at basically how realistic corpses are in films and television programs. So kind of looking at it from a sort of forensic archaeology perspective, and looking at how realistic the corpses are presented based on what has happened to them in that film.
Are you looking at like fully fleshed corpses as well as like going down to skeletal material?
Yes, we are, yeah. So we decided that it would be an interesting way to do some sort of science outreach, looking at things like decomposition processes and forensics and what have you, without having to worry about the ethical side of using real material. So you can still generate a really interesting discussion around all these things, and you know, forensic taphonomy and all that kind of stuff, but using movie corpses, which may or may not be very realistic depending on what you're looking at. And actually, so far, the ones that we've been looking at have been surprisingly good.
Oh, right. Can you give us any clues about which corpses you've been looking at and which films?
The first episode, we decided to focus on a couple of different corpses that had been placed in water. And one of the ones that we've actually looked at is Laura Palmer from Twin Peaks.
Oh, wow. That's a good one to start with.
So, and I think also people are quite familiar with her as well. She's quite famous. She's quite a famous corpse.
Well, that sounds fascinating, and I definitely want to be watching that. Thank you. I'm looking forward to that coming out with you and Chloe. See, I annoy my family sometimes when, particularly just skeletons annoy me. I don't really know that much about kind of more recent victims, as it were, corpses. But when skeletons are all beautifully not just articulated, but the bones are stuck together. That's just huge. And you've got this raised rib cage coming. It's like, oh my God, you've never dug up a skeleton, have you? And of course they haven't. Why would they have?
Sometimes as well, though, you can see that you can even see that they're wired together. Like you can literally see the wires holding the bones.
It's like we have wire insiders to keep up. Yeah. It's just a plastic skeleton they've got off Amazon or something, isn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. A lot of the time.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. When we had trouble recording with you, Lauren, we did talk to David Southwell and Beck Lambert and Simon Lunderdown about various films. Mm-hmm. The main one that we started with was very, very famous. And the one where it has good links to prehistory, because of course, because this podcast is supposed to be about prehistories, it's about how we represent the prehistoric past. And the Wicker Man has this, the Wicker Man, doesn't he? Mm. That comes from, I suppose it's not prehistoric, it's proto-historic descriptions of the people in Europe, in Northwest Europe, by Greeks and Romans, describing this Wicker Man that people and animals were put inside and then burned alive. And then it's transplanted to the present day, or at least the 70s anyway, to a remote island where the practices are still going on. And it's fascinating because it's entered the psyche that this is this definitely happened in prehistory, hasn't there?
Yeah. I think as well, with anything like the Wicker Man, I think we have to remember that there's probably an element of sort of neo-paganism about that. So in the Victorian period, there was a lot of people getting interested in sort of the classical and ancient past. And there was a bit of a resurgence, things like people being interested in druids based on things like, you say, like Greek and Roman accounts of what was going on over here and in other places in Northern Europe at that time and during prehistory. But we also have to remember that a lot of what Victorians wrote about and what they practiced or whatever and decided was what actually happened, a lot of it was invented.
Yeah, totally.
So I always like to think that all the stuff that's going on the Wicker Man, I mean, Christopher Lee's character, Lord Summerisle, does discuss at one point in the film about how Summerisle was actually put together as a settlement by his grandfather. And if we think about the age of Christopher Lee's character in the Wicker Man, which is set in the early 70s, his grandfather would probably have grown up during this sort of like Victorian revival of all these like neo-pagan apparent practices and druidic practices. So I think it's also interesting to look at it through that lens as well.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually, that I hadn't appreciated. And all this druidic stuff that happens around Stonehenge now and stuff is all kind of derives from that 18th and 19th century kind of
interpretation of it.
Reinterpretation, But even if you do go back to the source, the classical sources, where they're basically repeating this idea of the Wicker Man, and having looked at their, you know, each other's sources, as it were, and each other's writings, and it just gets repeated, and you wonder if any of them at all actually saw this in person, even though Caesar said he saw it, but he probably didn't. And you know what? Who first came up with this? Who first told them that this happened, or did anybody actually see it happening? I mean, yeah, that's not to say that human sacrifice didn't happen in the Iron Age. I mean, we do have definitely, there seems to be headhunting going on, doesn't there? You get kind of curation of various head trophies in different places. But then again, would we actually get much evidence from a Wicker Man? Would we be able to identify that? Huge burning episode.
That's so interesting. I mean, I'm now wanting to do some experimental archaeology building a Wicker Man.
Well, you could. Butts or Ancient Farm have done, often burn something huge and made out of wicker every year, don't they? I don't think they burn that much inside it, but that's the problem. You'd have to get loads of big joints of meat or something like that, wouldn't you? And burn it inside.
I mean, I'm just trying to think about, like, if you extrapolated out from these sorts of experiments that have been done looking at cremation practices and building cremation pyres and burning them down and then seeing what's left, you could totally build a massive Wicker Man, put a load of meat in it and like boned meat, and then burn it down and see what's left. Because I imagine that you'd end up with something like akin to a really big Buston burial, where you'd have like a large burnt patch, and then you'd have all this sort of like cremated wood ash and bone and other stuff like mixed up in it. Oh man, we should set this up. This sounds interesting.
I know, this sounds really good. It's like we should get, when Build and Burn, have you come across Build and Burn? They do build kind of Neolithic timber circles in various places in Scotland, and they get the community come and help build it, and then they burn it. And, you know, maybe that's something that they'd be interested in doing, because that I think it does also have that experimental side to it as well. Mm. And yeah, but and then you've got, like, obviously things can be done with all of that stuff, can't they? The processes of how that gets then preserved, the taphonomy of it would be interesting. So yeah, I think that's, could we ever identify a spot of a wicker man burning? Yeah.
I mean, yeah, amazing. Like you say, it depends on what they're doing with all the stuff afterwards, because if they just leave it there, then potentially we would find some of that, like we do with things like bust and burials. But if they're shoveling everything up and taking it away and putting it places and burying it around, or chucking it into the sea or doing whatever else, then you might not necessarily end up with anything except a large patch of residual burnt ground.
Exactly. And that'd be really difficult to identify, especially if it's away from any settlement, which you'd expect that they would do, because it would be a fire risk to burn down the settlement, wouldn't it? So, yeah, it's a shame. I think one of the other things that I suppose it's linked to human sacrifices as a different way of seeing life, that, and we'll talk about this with Midsummer in a little bit, but there's also this different attitude to sex, isn't there, in Wicker Man?
Oh yeah.
With Britt Eklund and her lovely dance and everything. Apparently she got the job in Man with the Golden Gun on the back of that dance.
Oh really?
Yeah, sadly they didn't make Christopher Lee do a naked dance to do get his role in Man with the Golden Gun. No, should have. Yeah, so, and obviously the whole point is that Edward Woodward's character is a virgin and very puritanically Christian, and it's about this dichotomy between the views of the world, i.e. human life, and having lots of sex. Is it good or bad? You know, so is that's kind of an interesting view, modern view, I think, maybe, of paganism, that it is kind of, and of Christianity. Mm. Christianity was always supposed to be puritanical, but you get, even in the 17th century, books for Christian couples about how to have great sex. So it's kind of one of those weird modern interpretations of the past, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the attitudes you get towards things like paganism and like the incorporation of like sex and fertility rights and things like that, I think a lot of it does come from sort of Christian attitudes saying, oh, you know, this is bad. This is why you don't want to be doing these things. You don't want to be following these old practices because they're bad and sex is bad. And look, we don't do things like that. You know, sex is only for procreation.
But I wonder if that's Victorian as well.
And well, it could be,
Not really that the early Christianity was not necessarily anti-sex, but that's something that's maybe a bit more Victorian, although you could question that as well, I suppose. I mean, is it a 20th century thing that we're so puritanical about sex?
I mean, it could be. It's interesting because, I mean, films anyway, this is not just limited to horror films, they are always very much product of their time, and they're always a reflection of kind of what's going on in society.
Exactly.
And you do get this sort of big folk horror resurgence in like the late 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
Even like in TV programs, like looking at, this is slightly different, but like all the M.R. James ghost stories and things like that. And so I think that the popularity of folk horror, and a lot of these folk horror tales do incorporate these sort of attitudes to sex, are probably tied in to things like the sort of sexual revolution in the 60s.
Yeah.
It's like almost a reaction to that.
Yeah. The free love. Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. And it's almost like, as you say, because the society at the time was wrestling with these issues, they pushed that back onto the past as well. And, you know, it's the same right now, all of the issues that we face, like climate change, that gets pushed back onto stories about prehistory. And I see that quite a lot in what we do. And like, for instance, one of my episodes was about Margaret Elphinstone's The Gathering Night. And it starts with a tsunami.
Right.
It's a Mesolithic tsunami. But you can tell that she's taken some of the descriptions of that event from the Boxing Day tsunami in the Philippines, Indonesia, that area as well. Yeah, it's these stories, that's what fascinates me so much, is that these stories we tell about prehistory are not really about prehistory at all. They're about now. And it's, yeah, it's, so do they tell us anything at all? I don't know. It's really weird. Anyway, yeah. Now, when I talked to everyone else who had seen Midsommar, they didn't like it at all. So this is quite a recent film, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I'm now struggling to think what year it was. Hang on, just give me 2 seconds.
It's like 2018 or something.
I'm going to Google it just to check, because I can't get this wrong. Editors, please cut me Googling this out. 2019.
Right, yes. And it looks so beautiful. I think I was really drawn in to the trailers and really kind of feeling like I needed to go and see it as well, because of that sense of that it's drawing on those ideas of maybe neo-paganism or a continuation of paganism and that kind of thing, and the links that might have to prehistory. And of course, Midsommar being very important in prehistory at certain points anyway, not all times. But it just obviously is a bit too scary for me, I think, so I never went to see it. But you love it.
I do love it, yeah. I mean, I must admit, I was very apprehensive about going to see it, because there'd been all the previews where, like, reviewers and things had gone to see it. There was a very, very heavy comparison being drawn with the 1973 Wicker Man, which is my favourite film ever. So I was a bit worried about all these comparisons and people saying, no, it's just better than the Wicker Man and all this stuff.
Oh, wow.
And anyway, I went to see it and I thought it was absolutely wonderful. It's such a great film. It's actually, I feel like it's a fairy tale more than anything else. And I've discussed this with a few of my friends as well. And there's quite a few of us in agreement that throughout all these awful things that happen in it, it's actually a fairy tale about Danny, the central character, who goes through such a terrible time through most of the film. But by the end of the film, she's been made into a queen and she's got everything that she ever wanted. So it's almost like a Disney story, Kim.
Wow.
If you want to, you could think about it like that. That might make it a bit more palatable.
Maybe. I'm not sure. I mean, I still cover my face up when I see the Ghostbusters ghost, you know. I don't know. But that is really fascinating, because I think fairy stories is not very far from horror at all.
No, not at all.
Yeah, I think they've got a very
crossover.
Yeah, and they've got, you know, like they've got the same origin, really, haven't they? In those old stories, because the original fairy tales were not all sweetness and light.
Oh, they are so dark.
So dark, yeah, and all about keeping children in line.
Yeah,
weren't they? Yeah, yeah. That's so interesting. It's so what is the premise? I mean, the premise is that somebody is visiting a place that is quite remote. Is that the idea? And coming across these strange rituals that happen around Midsommar? Is that?
Yeah. So the story is that there's basically a group of American students who go to Sweden to this rural community to go and take part in this Midsommar festival. So right. The setup is, so we've got our central character, Danny, who is very recently bereaved. Both her parents and her sister have died in really, really awful circumstances. She's in this terrible, terrible relationship with her boyfriend. So she's not in a good space at all. Her boyfriend and his PhD buddy are all going off. They're all anthropology students, and they're all going off to Sweden to their friend. Their friend is Swedish, and he's invited them to this festival that his village does every year. So they're going to go, and they're using it as part of, one of them is using it as part of his PhD for this anthropological study that he's doing. Danny also gets invited along to this festival, and when they get there, everything's not quite as it seems, and most of the group have basically been lined up as like human sacrifices for part of this Midsommar festival.
Whoa. And I'm just looking at images of it. It has that kind of almost like traditional folk costumes that people are wearing, which when you see them elsewhere are always like really jolly and fun, but it look quite sinister, obviously, at this point. And then there's the natural world coming in huge wildflower headdresses and things like that, that kind of then do kind of evoke those ideas of paganism and being part of that natural world. I mean, I'm just thinking of the god of wild things, Cernunnos, and things like that that you get in the late Iron Age. And there's is there a runestone that's part of it as well?
Yes, there's a lot of reference to, I think it's the Elder Futhark that's referenced quite a lot.
Right.
There's a lot of sort of Scandinavian runic imagery used in the film.
Yeah.
For example, one of the first kind of horrible things that you see in the film is, oh, are we allowed to do spoilers, Kim? Is that all right?
Oh yeah, go on then, because okay. I'm not going to see it.
So one of the scenes, which is like one of the first sort of awful things that we see, is there's a ceremony where everybody sits down for dinner. And there's an old couple who are sort of on these thrones at the end of the table. And then there's this ceremony sort of takes place and they get taken away in these, they're sort of carried away on these chairs. And then the next thing we see is all the village and the students we were also visiting are at the bottom of this cliff. And the two older people turn up there on the top of the cliff. And there's all these big stones that are carved in runes. And there's obviously some ritual going on up there. And they cut their hands and they wipe their hands and there's like blood all over these runestones and what have you. And then basically what happens is the two old people throw themselves off the cliff.
Oh, right.
And obviously this is considered something that's completely normal within the context of the actual villagers, but the visitors that are there are completely horrified by what they've seen. And this is sort of one of the first big indications that we get that something's not quite right.
Yeah.
There's been little hints of things up until then, but you could probably like pass it off as, oh, well, you know, we're just in a different culture. You know, we're just somewhere different. It's just a rural place, you know, and we're away from civilization, all that sort of stuff. But this is like the first big thing where everybody is like, holy crap, what is going on here?
Yeah. And it's like that thing where you think you're in another culture, and to what extent is our cultural practices all right and just different, and to what extent do we draw a line and say, you know what, people don't do that, which you can talk about in a lot of contexts today, which we won't go into because this isn't a sociology podcast, but that's what it reminds me of. But you, I mean, if we were to go back in time to various points in prehistory, say for instance the Neolithic, there'd be lots of really strange practices then, or indeed the Iron Age with cutting off people's heads as trophies, mm-hmm. and sticking them on spikes or on your house, you know. That would be a similar thing, wouldn't it? That's something that we would not really be able to cope with.
Yeah, and I think that there's a lot of stuff that we see in the archaeological record that's probably reflective of practices that either we're not even going to be able to fathom out because it's not anything that we have any sort of frame of reference for. Or even if we could figure it out, it's going to seem really weird to us. And that's what's going on in Midsommar. There's an actual explanation given for why these two old people have thrown themselves off this cliff in Midsommar. One of the other elder villagers explains that in their village, they have this sort of life cycle that everyone follows, and it's divided into four quarters. And so your first 18 years of life are spring, and that's when everybody is considered to be a child up until the age of 18. Hmm. And then summer is your second quarter of life, right through to when you get to 72 years of age. That's when it's considered to be the end of your natural life cycle. And that's sort of the end of your winter period, if you like. And when you get to the end of your 72 years, so that you're not a burden on society, you undertake this ritual and you kind of, well, chuck yourself off a cliff. So the way that it's explained, it all makes sense to the people that were doing it. You know, there's a reason behind it and everybody's happy to do it. But obviously to us, that's the, and also to Danny and her friends in the film, this all sounds completely abhorrent.
Yeah. It's interesting that we can justify all sorts of practices. And to us, we think we're in the default, don't we, in a way, the default mode, whereas a default mode is probably more likely to involve things like this, where you know, a lot more violence than we're used to today. And these interesting practices with human remains after they're dead as well. It's just something that's much more normal for people, even today around the world, but also very, very much as you go back into the past, the kind of things that people do with human remains. And but also not necessarily with people whilst they're alive, but I suppose mm-hmm. that's possible as well. But that's, yeah, I'm just feeling slightly kind of shaky just talking about
it. Oh, I'm sorry.
This is it. I just can't handle horror at all.
We could talk about the human remains, like doing stuff for people after death and things, because there's a lot of that going on in Midsommar as well. That's really interesting in relation to archaeology. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think I can handle that.
Yeah. So another thing that I did notice when I was watching Midsommar is that it's very interesting how they present what this community does with their dead.
Yeah.
After they've passed away, and what they do with human remains generally. So the old couple that I was speaking about before, they get taken for a cremation, and they've got this big sort of formalized cremation area where they render up the corpses down. And then once the ashes are cooled, they have a ceremonial tree, which is actually, it's not even a standing tree. It's like one that's fallen over. It's not clear whether it's one that's been cut down and put there and it's been there for a long time or what, but they've basically got an ancestral tree, and all the cremated ashes are scattered over the tree, which I think is something that's actually not, that's a, something a little bit more familiar for us. But then there's a part in the film where one of the American students who doesn't realize what this sort of tree is, he goes and he has a wee on it. And some of the villagers got absolutely mental because they're like, you're pissing on my ancestors.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that while it's not something necessarily that we do now, like exactly, but we can kind of relate to that, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
To those practices, you know, everybody's gone and, well, a lot of people have gone and scattered their relatives' ashes places, and whether that's a particular special place or whether it's just like in your garden or a memorial place or whatever. There's also, when the human sacrifice element sort of comes into the film later on, I did notice that there's a lot of random things done with human remains. Like there's somebody's walking around and you notice that there's a foot just sticking out of a flower bed.
Wow.
Like, and you don't know whether it's part of a full corpse or whether it's like a dismembered leg or something.
Yeah.
And it's got runes like carved onto the sole of the foot. And obviously everybody in the village is just sort of like walking around as though this is normal.
Yeah.
And that really got me thinking about the sort of archaeological things that we see from prehistoric contexts, where we might get human remains somewhere that you wouldn't typically consider to be like a funerary context.
Yeah.
And you're like thinking
coming
about...
coming back into the community, into settlements and
well
stuff.
Yeah, because like, I mean, say in the Iron Age, you get bits of dead people turning up in like storage pits and ditches and God knows what else, like all sorts of places that we don't typically consider to be funerary, but obviously to them, these things are not just ending up in there by accident.
No, exactly. Near me in Aylesbury, there was a midden in the hill fort, and there was a decapitated human body on there.
Oh, wow.
And obviously just skeletal material and a whole goat as well. So it's something,
that's not an accident, is it?
It's not an accident. It's something that's going on similar to what you see. And we've kind of very much taken death away from the, you know, from our everyday lives, haven't we, over the last few hundred years. But there's something about it that we still are so interested in. Why is it that we want to scare ourselves with stories like this? What is it because I do watch slightly scary things that I can handle and enjoy them, and why is that? Why do we do that to ourselves?
I think there's something to be said about, you know, that even if you are scared, that you're safe while that thing's happening. I mean, if you thought that these things were going to happen to you in real life, obviously you wouldn't put yourself in that situation. But there's, I think that a lot of people, and I know I certainly do, get a bit of an adrenaline rush off it. So you're watching something, you get scared. Quite often people, after they've been scared, they will start laughing afterwards. And there's sort of like that release, you get the adrenaline rush and blah, blah, blah. And I think a lot of this is to do with the rush of being scared, but within a safe environment.
Yeah, Yeah, I guess so. One of my friends loves horror, and she always talks about having the coolest dreams after watching something good where she's like fighting zombies or whatever. I particularly hate zombies. I just can't handle them. I had to switch off Piranha because I could not handle the big carnage scene at the where somebody was cut in half and someone's face was ripped off. I could not handle it. And I had survivor's guilt. I really felt like, oh my God, what's going on? All those people died. And something like Jaws, for instance, when I first watched it, I think I was probably a bit too young there. I love it now. I think it's brilliant. But yeah, I couldn't swim in swimming pools for a long time because I was actually, that might have been James Bond that made me do that, actually, thinking about it. Yeah, I'm quite suggestive, as you can tell.
You know what, though? I have a similar thing about Jaws because I must have been quite young when I watched it. And as you said, I really love the film now, but I still can't swim out of my depth, like in the sea. I hate it.
I can't swim in the sea, no way.
Absolutely not. I can go up to about like my waist height and then anything after that, no.
Yeah, I need to be able to get out of the water just in case the shark's coming. Yeah, you know, off Suffolk or whatever. So, yeah, but it just seems to be, and because these stories, very scary stories, as we say, fairy tales have got such a long history, haven't they? Mm-hmm. And we've got these stories that go back into prehistory, and obviously some of them probably have survived. There was a what was it called, historical linguistic study of fairy tales that suggested that because of the similarities between fairy tales from really widely separated cultures, they probably go back like to the Bronze Age. Like Beauty and the Beast, I think, was one of them.
Oh, wow.
Which is weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just to think of that in some form or other, it's been around for 5,000 years. And obviously people must have had loads of stories that just sadly don't survive. Mm-hmm. But there's always that sense of there's a lot of scary stories around that we love to tell each other. We love to tell children and terrify them out of their wits to keep them in line and make sure that they don't do anything bad because something's going to come and get them. It just is such a human thing to have to work through those emotions through stories, I think. As you say, it's something about you tell the story, but you know that at that point you're telling the story, you're actually safe. And you work through what your reactions would be if that actually happened.
And also they're good as like a warning tale or like a morality tale or whatever. And we also see this like in modern times. I mean, just think about, again, going back to the 1970s, all the things like the Spirit of Dark Water adverts telling people not to go playing in quarries.
Oh yeah!
Do you remember have you seen these?
About those.
If anybody doesn't know what I'm talking about, who's listening? Like, you can put Spirit of Dark Water into YouTube. There's a series of like absolutely terrifying adverts, which were basically serving as a public safety thing about like kids not going and playing in quarries and drowning or getting hurt or whatever. But they're filmed with like this. They're narrated by this awful ghostly figure who also like is seen lurking in the background of these scenes, sort of watching over these children who are doing stuff that they shouldn't be doing. And the adverts are basically saying, don't do this, otherwise the Spirit of Dark Water is going to come and get you.
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh God. I remember those. Oh, I was thinking of some other advert. Oh yeah. There was a lot of stuff at public health warnings about what to do in case of a nuclear attack.
Oh, there's loads of things like that.
And like threads that we were all made to watch when we were at school. Where it was Sheffield, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was,
getting killed. And it's like, why are we watching this? Yeah.
There's another one as well that I saw that I think my friend programmed at a film festival, at Celluloid Screens Film Festival, and it was basically a public safety advert telling kids not to play on railway lines, but it goes on for forever. And then you see there's like these kids basically having a sports day on a railway line, and then like loads of them get killed by a train, and like there's just like kids covered in blood everywhere. And you think like this was being put out as like an advert.
Yeah, on just general in between Andy Pandy or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think that those public health warnings have moved away from being too graphic now, and certainly for kids, that it doesn't really help to scare them into doing things. And as a parent, the parenting strategies are different. We don't tend to scare our kids with like the stranger who'll come and kidnap them. Mm. We don't want to tell them about that. We don't want to yeah, scare them with the some kind of mystical figure, magical figure that lives under the bed, and the bogeyman will come and get them. But it was a massive thing. I wonder if also people's lives in the past would have been quite scary. There would have been a lot more threat from other people, from wild animals, from just general things happening that we can now control, from the weather and stuff. We can't control the weather, but, you know, we can control a little bit more about
how mitigate against it.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, mitigate against it. That you know, it was important really to be working through some of these issues in stories in that safe way, in a way. Now we just, maybe we still just crave that fear because we don't have a fear response that much. Although we have the luxury.
I think a lot of people, especially in like Western civilization, have the luxury of not having that many things to be genuinely scared about. I'm not saying that there's nothing to be scared about, especially like in the current sort of socio-political climate that we're living in.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot to be said about we don't have the same types of things to be scared about as you would have done in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right. And so we look to the past for some of those. Although, of course, there's plenty of horror that also plays on our current fears as well. Mm. Well, it's been really great to talk to you, Lauren. I think we're going to come to, we could talk for ages, but we've come to a halt there because I've got so much material now for my double episode on horror, and we're going to revisit horror at Christmas, definitely. Yay. I think that'll be great. I can deal with, well, we did watch one of the Krampuses and Rare Exploits is just brilliant. It's just so good. I love it. So yes, definitely we'll talk to you again, and we'll celebrate Christmas when hopefully we'll be able to go out and, you know, do things, which would be lovely. But thank you so much. I'm really glad that we managed to make this happen, Lauren.
Oh yeah, me too. It was really fun.
And it worked perfectly this time.
Good.
I don't know what was going on before, but it was great.
I'm going to blame my crappy internet connection that I've now got rid of.
Yeah, yeah. Great. Thank you for upgrading just for us. But thank you so much. It's been really lovely to talk to you. And
no problem.
I will put links to your new podcast.
Yeah.
The Rate That Corpse, I think it's called.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I'll send you the link when it comes out. Chloe, I'll have to check. She was hoping it was going to come out like in the next couple of days. So I'll send you a link when I've got one.
Yeah, fantastic. Because it'll probably be out by the time this episode airs. So I'm so glad we managed to chat.
Yeah, me too.
Well, we have crawled out of the darkness of our triple bill of folk horror. Were there any classic folk horror films or TV shows that we didn't look at that have those prehistoric echoes running through them? Sorry for all the mixed metaphors there. Do let us know what you thought about all of these films and stories, and if there's anything that we missed. Now, next month, I'm going to be talking to Beck Lambert again, who was in episode 1 and 2 of the Folk Horror Special. And if you remember, is a punk archaeologist, otherwise known as Lady Liminal. And I'll also be joined by Rebecca Stott, who is an author of and lecturer in historical fiction at the University of East Anglia. And we're going to be discussing Robert Harris's book, The Second Sleep. So do get hold of it so that you can read it and then listen to what we think. But send me any of your thoughts on the book in advance as well. Look forward to hearing from you.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.